Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 45% of U.S. tap water contaminated with PFAS, forever chemicals. So far, the scale of contamination in local water systems and private wells outpaces detection and cleanup efforts. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, the United States Geological Survey, USGS, announced recently that at least 45% of tap water nationwide is likely contaminated with one or more type of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, a family of harmful forever chemicals that do not break down in the environment and can now be widely detected in water supplies and virtually all of American people's bodies. Independent testing has found PFAS contamination in fresh water sources such as groundwater, rivers, and lakes, as well as drinking water at more than 2,800 sites across the U.S. But USGS says its study is the first to test both public and private water systems on such a broad and national scale. It's pretty shocking, but at the same time, not that shocking that PFAS is probably in 45% of tap water, because PFAS is so prevalent, Hayes said in an interview. PFAS is an extensive family of synthetic chemicals with a variety of consumer and industrial uses, ranging from cleaning products and nonstick lining in fast food packaging to firefighting foam. Research is ongoing, but exposure to high levels of some types of PFAS is linked to cancer and a host of other health problems, including hormone dysfunction and a weakened immune system. The chemicals also cause damage to the environment, where they can persist for decades in water and the bodies of fish and other wildlife. The USGS reports that there are more than 12,000 known types of PFAS chemicals, but testing cannot detect all of them at once. The USGS tested for 32 common types of PFAS at sites across the U.S. and modeled the results based on proximity to potential sources of PFAS pollution. Research hydrologist Kelly Smalling, the study's lead author, said USGS tested water directly from public water systems and kitchen sinks across the U.S. Smalling said in a statement recently, the study estimates that at least one type of PFAS of those that were monitored could be present in nearly half of the tap water in the U.S. Furthermore, PFAS concentrations were similar between public supplies and private wells. PFAS exposure often occurs via consuming contaminated food and water, or using products that contain PFAS, including some non-stick products and packaging. Testing suggests that most people in the U.S. are exposed to PFAS and have forever chemicals in American people's blood, especially perfluorooctane, sulfonic acid, PFOS, and perfluorooctanic acid, PFOA. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, PFOS and PFOA dominated the potential human exposure risk in USGS tap water samples. Nationally, there are thousands of potential and suspected industrial sources of PFAS pollution, ranging from airports and oil refineries to paper mills and manufacturers of paint and fishing products, according to the Environmental Working Group. Hay said industrial facilities that use or produce PFAS are often located near low-income areas and communities of color that are disproportionately burdened by air and water pollution. There are currently no federal clean water regulations for controlling this PFAS pollution, although the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is reportedly developing regulations for some types of industries. In the meantime, the EPA is encouraging states to use their clean-up water permitting programs to limit the amount of PFAS contaminated water discharged into drinking water supplies and treatment facilities. The chemical companies that manufacture and sell PFAS itself have faced a deluge of lawsuits over PFAS contamination in drinking water supplies. 3 Million, a major producer of PFAS and related products, recently reached a $10.3 billion settlement with U.S. cities and towns facing PFAS contamination in municipal water systems. Three other PFAS sellers, including Chemours, DuPont, and Corteva, announced a similar $1.19 billion settlement over drinking water contamination last week. All four companies have denied wrongdoing. There are 30,000 to 40,000 industrial sites across the U.S. that are likely having PFAS discharges into local storm and wastewater streams, Hayes said, adding, so that settlement money is a drop in the bucket and they are going deal it with it forever. Another major source is military bases, where PFAS has long been a key ingredient in firefighting foam used to put out oil fires and burning jet fuel. Groundwater contaminated with PFAS has impacted people living on and around dozens of military bases. More than 400 current and former military sites are known to be contaminated with PFAS. Also, according to Hill, a new federal study estimates that toxic forever chemicals can be found in nearly half of U.S. tap water. Forever chemicals, also known as PFAS or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, can be found in at least 45% of U.S. tap water, according to the study from U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, released recently. The study, which used modeling based on samples collected from 716 locations across the United States over several years, found urban areas are more at risk than rural ones when it comes to PFAS contamination. The chemicals were found in about 70% of areas that are either urban or have a known history of PFAS contamination, compared to just 8% of rural areas. It also found that the substances may be more common in the Great Plains, Great Lakes, Eastern Seaboard, and Central and Southern California regions. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. On June the 5th, 1989, the funeral of Iranian leader Grand Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini took place in Tehran. It's estimated that around 10 million people participated in his funeral, the largest number of people ever to attend a funeral procession and also one of the largest gatherings in human history. On today's show, we're going to ask, who was Imam Khomeini? And we're going to examine his immense contribution to Islamic revival. But first, here's a brief overview of his extraordinary life.
June 3, 1989, saw the passing of a titan of modern history, a man who changed the political landscape of the Middle East forever, the founder of a new state on the back of a revolution which toppled the tyrant and upset the West's imperialist stranglehold on the region. Born May 1900, Imam Khomeini would become an influential Muslim cleric and marja, who went on to become the political leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran, which overthrew the monarchy headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran. Following the revolution, Iran became an Islamic republic. Imam Khomeini ascended to the post of Grand Leader, the paramount figure in the political system of the new Islamic Republic, until his demise. His successful campaign to topple the Western-backed dictator of Iran wasn't his only great lifetime achievement. He successfully led Iran's defense in a costly invasion by Iraq between 1980 and 1988, implemented a democratic process for Iranians, and set the country on course to full independence from foreign interference. Under Imam Khomeini's leadership, freedom struggles across the region also received huge support, with Lebanon and Palestine specifically benefiting from Iran's help in fighting back against Israel's colonialist project. Perhaps more importantly, Imam Khomeini proved that the religious Islamic system could successfully govern a modern country, opening the doors to a model of political Islam, which inspired Muslims across the Ummah to live by Islam in all areas, not only privately, but in all spheres of daily life. The Islamic Republic has now become a safe haven for Muslims and Islamic practice amid a rising Islamophobic atmosphere gripping the globe. Every year, his passing is mourned by millions of Muslims across the world, his legacy continuing to inspire many more decades after his passing.
Well, joining us today to talk about Imam Khomeini, we have two esteemed guests, Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a Muslim scholar and lecturer based here in the UK, and Shabir Razvi, a poet, writer, broadcaster, political and economic commentator. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Sayyid, let me come to you first of all, because you know, you've been to Iran many times, you've seen the impact that the revolution has had on that country and the wider region as well. Just tell me about Imam Khomeini and his legacy and what it's achieved, not just for Iran, but for the region in general.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. It's good to be here, especially with the important personality like Sheikh Hanif here with us. Look, I have had the privilege and honour to be at Imam Khomeini's funeral itself.
Okay.
There was a group of people here, youngsters. We were young at that time, getting old and decrepit
You're
now.
You're young at this time. You're young at this time.
At that time, many years ago. So all of a sudden, when we heard that Imam Khomeini had died, literally within 12 hours, we were on the flight from here, about 22 of us, with six scholars based in London. And there were two particular incidents which, one can remember. One was the arrival of Imam Khomeini from Paris to Tehran. That was, again, a huge sort of outpouring of people on the streets. I can't remember the numbers, but it was millions who turned up to greet him when he arrived in Tehran. And the second one was this particular time when he died, when he departed from amongst us. 10 million, perhaps even more, were there. And when we arrived there back in 1989, it was just literally, people were crying, the officials at the airport were crying. It was an extraordinary sort of outpouring of the people that really loved an individual of Imam Khomeini's stature. And when one thinks of how did he impact so many people, he wasn't their father, he wasn't their cousin or their uncle or whatever, he was another third person. But people had immense love for him, no matter what the West says and maligns him. But the reality is that the people were in love with him, not just in Iran, but abroad. Youngsters like me who grew up in London, we didn't have any, going to university in the 70s in London, one didn't have a model that one could talk to the world about. Either you had communism or socialist philosophy at university, and there was no dialogue about Islam. Islam wasn't on the agenda. There wasn't, as you said, in the introduction, that there was no model for world to see. And this is, I think, it's very difficult to talk about the legacy of Imam Khomeini, because it's like pouring an ocean of water in a jug. It's so immense that one can't do justice in a half an hour, 45 minutes program.
Of course,
on this particular individual.
We will do our best, certainly. Let me bring in the Sheikh on this, because I want to get your view specifically on the religious achievements of Imam Khomeini and also his revolution. Now, as Sayyid Shabir mentioned very accurately, at the time of the revolution, communism was very prominent, and there was this kind of Cold War situation going off between the capitalist West and the communist East. Imam Khomeini came in, changed the face of not only Iran but the region, and I think Islam and political Islam were the biggest benefactors of his activities. Just elaborate for us this point, because I know how important it's been for the Muslim world that Imam Khomeini came to succeed.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Just to sort of piggyback on what the Sayyid was saying, in terms of, the kind of world that existed at the time, the political world that existed at the time, the major struggles were between communism and capitalism. And so you found a kind of a colonialism of ideas, in the sense that the majority of the ideologies used by non-Western countries that used to be called third world countries to fight imperialism, they tended to always use Western types of ideas and models and so forth. Islam up to that point, meaning the point where Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, came onto the scene, was largely forgotten or placed aside in preference to other, quote-unquote, more meaningful or more rational or more scientific, you hear this word a lot, scientific socialism and so forth, applications of Western ideas. What Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, did when he spearheaded this Islamic revolution was the revival of Islamic political thought as a means of counteracting Western imperialism. From my own personal experience, you find that a lot of African Americans and Afro-Caribbean type people, people in the African diaspora, in our fight against indigenized imperialism, you know, they used to call communities like ourselves or the American Indians or the American Native people as a fourth world, meaning the third world within a Western environment. In our confrontation with the totalistic aspect of in interior domination, we as African Americans did not see, when I say African Americans, I mean the Americas, not just the US, did not see socialism or liberalism as sufficient ideologies to fight that, because we were fighting things like cultural imperialism, you know, the domination of Christian ideology and so forth. And so we had people like Malcolm X, for example. You know, we've had experiences of Islam even back in the times of slavery, where the majority of the slave uprisings were carried out by Muslims. We did find in Islam an answer. And for many of us, this became crystallized externally as a reality for us in the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which illustrated to us, especially the appropriateness of Islam as a liberation movement.
Now, Sayyid Shabir, one thing I want to learn more about is Imam Khomeini as a Muslim leader. Basically, what was unique about him from that perspective when he came into the scene? What did he change? Not just the political landscape, but the Muslim landscape. What was different about him?
That really is quite a fascinating question, and really following up from the Sheikh's sort of analysis, is it wasn't just an impact on the political scene. It was an impact on the cultural scene. It was an impact on the social scene. It was an impact on the educational scene. So, you know, it was a wide variety of sort of aspects of society. Say, for example, you know, in London in the 60s and the 70s, you wouldn't see many women wearing scarf. So that was a, not a political, but a religious cultural impact that took place. And, you know, educationally, universities were closed down for 3 years soon after the revolution because they wanted to cleanse the education system of the Western influences that you were referring to, Sheikh. And at a social level, you know, people started to understand what were the Islamic etiquettes to operate in a social environment, so that, you know, whether mixing of the genders was concerned. So really, you know, as I said, one's got to sort of break it down at different levels. And of course, the impact of an individual was so phenomenal that no one could really sort of get away from it. You had to talk about it. Whether you liked the individual or you didn't like it, the conversation had to have. And that has been going on for the last 43 years, and it has continues till this day. So the impact on the Muslim world, as I said, in different areas of human life happened. And not only that, in the West itself, you know, as I said in my earlier comment, those of us who were young and living in London, the families were religious, they would go to the mosque or the Husseiniyas, go for ziyarat and whatever. But really, someone doing those mandatory aspects of religion were not sufficient enough, because it required one to operate as a full human being to be understanding what the social life is all about, what education we are receiving, does it have Islamic basis to that? And at a cultural level, you know, one can talk and talk that the impact culturally has been just incredible over the last 40 years.
I like the fact that Imam Khomeini made absolutely clear that you can live by Islam, not just in your own private life, but in all aspects of life, political, social, as you mentioned, the revival of the hijab as well. It's almost like he instilled a pride in our Muslim identity, and it should, you know, reflect our identity in all spheres at all times. That's something which I admire very much so. Sheikh, what I want to ask you is about this title of Imam. It's obviously something which he's known by, but not everyone may understand its significance or the meaning behind it. So perhaps you could explain the title of Imam. Why was he referred to as Imam Khomeini rather than by, say, his full name normally, or as a Grand Ayatollah only? What's the significance of the Imam title?
Well, you know, the name Imam has always been in the Muslim world and in Muslim history. Apart from, you know, the usual ritual aspects in terms of the imam of prayer and that type of thing, the name of imam as a political concept has always been in Islamic history. If you look at Islamic history, before even the determination of the word khilafah, you know, as a word to describe or designate the leader of the Muslim ummah, you know, we had the word imam, you know, that preceded this idea. And so Imam Khomeini, in this case, represents a political aspect. But he also reflected in himself a general leadership of Islamic thought, in Islamic thought in the society. So when we're talking about the general the political leadership.
And Sayyid, one thing I want to ask you as well is, you know, he's something, it was like a Shia revolution, leader, political leader, religious leader, and it's Shia Islam that's benefited from it. But that's not actually the case, is it?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, you know, Imam Khomeini himself very clearly pointed out in his speeches, in his writings, and post-revolution very clearly that neither was it an Iranian revolution, nor was it a Shia revolution. Yeah. It was really an awakening. I like the word awakening more than revolution, because it awakened the Muslim masses to understand that, you know, you used the word pride in your earlier conversation. Pride has different meanings. Pride can make one arrogant. But this was pride really to sort of gain the dignity that was being sort of lost by the Muslim Ummah and also the oppressed people. Because the beauty of the revolution was that it wasn't just, as I said, confined to Iranians or to the Shias. It was for the whole oppressed world. And that's why, one of the reasons why from day one that Imam Khomeini supported the Palestinian cause. You know, Palestinians, 99%, 98% are Sunnis. But at the end of the day, you know, the pain that Iran has suffered is because they have supported the Palestinian cause for the last 43 years, if you like. Yeah. So it was supporting the oppressed people. That's why you look at it, why Iran supports Venezuela, why Iran supports Cuba, why Iran supports all the people all over the world. And that again is coming back from the Islamic ethos, because one of the message of Karbala, of Imam Hussein, was to stand up against the oppressor and to support the oppressed. And this was the key phrase, I think, that, and it resonates with anyone. You know, you talk to someone in London or Washington or Paris, they will know who the oppressor is and who the oppressed are. therefore, it was, you know, the language was also, as I said, I talked about the culture and so the language itself also changed. And I just wanted to make a comment, you know, your commentary in the beginning talked about Middle East and even the geography, the words that we use. It's not Middle East, it's West Asia. It's not Far East, it's Southeast Asia. You know, these are, again, words which we have adopted from the sort of, even at a geographic level, from the colonial mindset, if you like, which the Islamic Revolution...
Eurocentric.
colonial Eurocentric, if you like. And that, it's in itself, is very important, that how we use the language, the vocabulary, that Imam Khomeini inspired people to understand that words and language have meaning to it, and it has to be used in a way that contextualizes what really is happening in the world.
One thing I want to ask you before I move back to the Sheikh is, you mentioned earlier in the show that you remember the time, the revolutionary time, the time when Imam Khomeini returned from Paris and it changed the face of Iran and the region forever. I want to ask you about what you remember the impact was on, say, Muslims here in the UK. So I, for example, might say that that was the start of the British Muslim community when we saw his reaction to like the Salman Rushdie case. He encouraged Muslims and inspired Muslims elsewhere in the world to actually, you know, unite and stand together. So Britain, of course, is, there are Muslims from different backgrounds, different countries, different ethnicities, different sects, but it seems as if there was a period after the revolution where Muslims began to engage with one another out on a street level and actually stand up for their beliefs and basically campaign and that type of thing. So just tell me, what impact did Imam Khomeini have on, say, the Muslim community here in the UK at the time? Do you remember?
Yes, I remember it vividly. I was in the demonstration against Salman Rushdie in London at that time when there were, I don't know, some people say a million, half a million Muslims turned up at that time. It was an incredible sort of sighting of Muslims. And they were not Shia Muslims. Obviously, you know, Shias are not a majority in the UK. They're 10, 20%. But majority of the individuals were Sunni. And then you had, you know, incredible people at that time like Kalim Siddiqui Mahroom, who was a Sunni, but a real advocate of the Islamic Revolution. Similarly, Brother Bangash in Canada, again another Sunni individual who writes phenomenally and speaks in support of the Islamic Revolution. Ahmed Didar, a South African, again, who visited Iran, and I had the privilege of meeting him when he was in London at that time. So, you know, you've got to look at it, and it was really such a rapid change that occurred in individuals who were, I mean, it gives away my age that, you know, I'm incredibly old to have lived through all that, it had a huge impact on the generation that was in their 20s or just coming out of university or were at university.
Do you think it brought more people closer to Islam?
I have no doubt it has. Hmm. And that, I think, we are living through in 2023, where Muslims are being, you know, Islamophobia has become a very common place now.
Yes.
And it's, you know, some might say that it's because of the revolution that, you know, people have become Islamophobic. No, that's not the case at all. Sort of the Western ideology has been always against Islam.
You know, I think the Islamic Revolution is a counterbalance to fight back against the rise of Islamophobia.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Sheikh, we haven't got a lot of time left. I do apologize, but I will end the show with your comments on this. Just tell me, what do you think in terms of how he's impacted the community in a positive sense? Could you perhaps list some of the positive legacies that we live on from today, the Imam Khomeini inspired during his time?
I think one thing that the Imam, first of all, the Imam was fundamentally a cleric, okay? And he was a revolutionary secondarily, okay? And what about his clericism that it affected this transformation? And I think it has a lot to do with, for example, the incorporation of the idea of rationalism, as would be endemic in the Usuli type of school of thought in Shiaism, the ability to look at our history, look at our Islamic sources to find guidance in terms of, fighting that, in terms of also incorporating certain modern ideas, you know, like, for example, ideas of imperialism, for example, you know, and looking at broad solidarity among the different third world peoples, you know, and also people inside Western countries, inside Western countries, for general common features where we could support, as you would mention, Venezuela, you know, which is basically a Christian country, support Palestine and Lebanon, you know, which are largely majority Sunni countries and so forth. So he revived this idea of pan-Islamism, basically.
Mm, yes.
You know what I mean? So where Muslims could unite. And of course, interestingly enough, the backlash to that would be the creation of a dark Islam, which we would call Wahhabism or Salafism, you know, that really is sort of the straw man that Western policy has created in order to show Islam in barbaric lights and so forth.
Trying to divide Muslims.
Right, which is really where Islamophobia comes from.
That is a very strong point. I wish we had more time to discuss it. Unfortunately, we don't, Sheikh, but I'm sure we'll have you back on the show, as well as you, Sayed Razvi. Thank you so much to everyone for joining us this week. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we will be back again for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The prosecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is already a threat to the free press, even before his first day in a US courtroom. The US Justice Department is using vague threats to pressure journalists to cooperate with the prosecution of Julian Assange. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. The US Justice Department is pressuring some British journalists to cooperate with the prosecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is accused of publishing classified US military documents leaked to him by a whistleblower. According to Rolling Stones' James Ball, who said he's among the journalists being pressured to cooperate, the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, are using vague threats and pressure tactics in their efforts to receive journalists helping in building a case against Julian Assange. Rolling Stones' James Ball is sought by the Department of Justice as someone who had briefly worked and lived with Julian Assange. He wrote the first attempt at receiving his cooperation in Assange's prosecution came through London's Metropolitan Police in December of 2021. He remained silent at the time on the advice of counsel, but has since learned that more journalists have had police show up at their doorsteps in recent days. former Guardian investigations editor David Lee, transparency campaigner Heather Brooke, and writer Andrew O'Hagan have all been approached by police. James Ball was first contacted about helping in the Julian Assange case by a Metropolitan Police officer on the Special Investigations team, who had called him on a blocked number that Ball failed to answer. He then received a deliberately innocuous email from the police. A lawyer spoke to police on Ball's behalf and learned the United States and Britain were asking him to testify about a story that he wrote on Julian Assange's relationship with Israel Shamir, an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin, adding that without Ball's testimony, the US government cannot make much use of what he revealed in the article in a court of law. James Ball said he was more than willing to write about his relationship with Julian Assange in the media, but he does not believe that it should be used to help a vindictive prosecution of Julian Assange. An officer told James Ball's lawyer that US intelligence agencies claim to have discovered that James Ball doesn't exist, which Ball said was a false accusation, as the name is his actual birth name that has never changed. After seeking further legal advice, James Ball was told by multiple attorneys not to travel to the United States or speak out publicly over concerns about potential prosecution for his refusal to cooperate with US authorities. Website RollingStone.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is facing an uphill legal battle over his potential extradition from London, where he has been held at the high-security Belmarsh prison, to the United States over WikiLeaks' 2010 publication of a top-secret cables detailing war crimes committed by the U.S. government at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba at detention camps in Iraq and Afghanistan. The materials, which were leaked to him by then-US soldier Chelsea Manning, expose instances of the CIA engaging in torture and rendition. WikiLeaks also published a video showing the US military gunning down civilians in Iraq, including two Reuters journalists. The Australian journalist would face 17 charges for receiving, possessing, and communicating classified information to the public under the Espionage Act, and one charge alleging a conspiracy to commit computer intrusion if he's extradited to the United States, and could be sentenced to as many as 175 years in an American maximum security prison. Chelsea Manning was convicted by the Barack Obama administration's Department of Justice in 2013 of violations of the Espionage Act and other offences over the Cablegate leak. Julian Assange has been held at Belmarsh Prison in England since he was removed from the Ecuadorian embassy 4 years ago for breaching jail conditions. He had sought asylum at the embassy in London to avoid extradition to Sweden over allegations that he abused two women because Sweden would not promise him protection from extradition to the United States. The investigations into the sexual assault allegations were eventually dropped. Last year, the editors and publishers of US and European news outlets had worked with Julian Assange on the publications of excerpts from more than 250,000 documents that he obtained in the Cablegate leak. The Guardian, The New York Times, Le Monde and Der Spiegel and El País wrote an open-ended letter calling for the United States to end its prosecution of Julian Assange. The Obama administration elected against indicting Assange after WikiLeaks published the cables in 2010 because it would have had to give the same treatment to journalists over other major news outlets that worked with Julian Assange on the documents. But former President Donald Trump's Department of Justice later moved to indict Assange under the Espionage Act, and the Joe Biden administration has continued to pursue this prosecution. Julian Assange's case has received the attention of some lawyers on Capitol Hill, with Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat of Michigan, leading a letter to the Department of Justice demanding the charges against him be dropped. Lawmakers in Australia and other countries have also pushed the United States to end its prosecution of Julian Assange. Pope Francis recently met with Assange's wife, Stella, who said the Pope expressed support for her family's situation and concern about Julian Assange's suffering. The German magazine Der Spiegel has also covered the same story and tells us more. Activists, lawyers, journalists linked to WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange are being subjected to extensive surveillance and intimidation. Individuals have been hacked, tracked, burglarized, threatened with death, and thrown in jail for years on dubious charges. While the identity of the perpetrators has yet to be conclusively proven, victims say it's clear that who's behind the campaign of harassment and spying. America's Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. In a recent interview with a German news outlet, internet neutrality activist Andy Müller-Magoon, who links the incidents to the CIA's classification of WikiLeaks as hostile in 2017, condemned the tactics as intimidation surveillance by U.S. intelligence agencies and their collaborators abroad, stating that the point all these years has been made to make it abundantly clear we're out to get you. Andy Müller-Magoon, whose phone was reportedly physically tapped with a field programmable gate array carrying US-made chips and which cannot be detected with a normal frequency locator, was just one of many apparent victims targeted by the CIA for their association with WikiLeaks. Julian Assange's lawyer, Ato Martinez, said, "For his team, there is no question that Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks organization, and everyone surrounding Julian are being systematically monitored and intimidated, whether it's their supporters, journalists, lawyers, or family members." Ato Martinez himself is reportedly no stranger to the unsavory activities of U.S. intelligence services. Having served as Julian Assange's legal counsel for the better part of a decade, he also described a series of unsettling events which indicate he's being monitored and harassed by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA.
Hidden Files.
Around 2 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, November 28, 1953, something rather strange happened at a New York City hotel. A scientist got up in the middle of the night, ran across a dark room, avoiding two beds, and dove through a closed window with the shades and curtains down, then died soon after he hit the ground. His name was Frank Olson, and his death would help uncover a series of secret CIA operations involving the lives of thousands. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today's mind-blowing topic is a CIA mind control project called MKUltra. The story of MKUltra is at times so surreal that one may think it's the plot of a science fiction movie, but unfortunately, it is very much true and affected thousands of people around the world, although no one is sure of the actual numbers because of the secrecy of the program. It was a Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, top secret program, which used humans as guinea pigs to test a range of drugs that could force confessions or brainwash individuals through various forms of psychological torture. Well, you see, in the 1950s, the CIA initiated this program to experiment with forms of mind control in order to, and I quote, to catch up with the Soviets and Chinese advances in the field. 80 institutions and 185 private researchers had contracts with the CIA to perform this work, and they were located around the world, as were their victims. So Sidney Gottlieb was the CIA's main man handling this project. He was a chemist, and some of his experiments were covertly funded at universities and research centers. Others were conducted in American prisons and in detention centers in Japan, Germany, and the Philippines. Now, according to journalist Stephen Kinzer, Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds, and he realized that it was a two-part process. Well, first, you had to blast away, imagine that, blast away the existing mind. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mind into that resulting void. Well, according to Kinzer, the United States didn't get too far on number two, but they did a lot of work on number one. There were a core group of scientists around the world who were part of MKUltra. LSD, sleep deprivation, and electric shock treatments were their favorite tools to use on their victims, but it was not limited to those. They would induce people into a high with putting them into having hallucinations, then giving them a drug to bring them down. And while in between these phases, some of them would give their victims mini electric shock treatments, basically having people lose their minds. Take a look at this.
This is where I have my effect, in the mind.
This is lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as acid. The powerful drug was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. With a dose of mere micrograms, the mind becomes confused. Perception is distorted. Personal identity is called into question. The results can be euphoric bliss or deadly panic.
So that was how LSD was introduced to this country.
Operation Midnight Climax is part of a larger top-secret CIA program called MKUltra. The goal: learn how to control and even reprogram people's minds. The CIA believes LSD might hold the key. Over the next 10 years, the agency doses a cross-section of the American public. Everyone from unwitting housewives to soldiers to even criminals like gangster Whitey Bulger is tested.
You know, what the CIA really dreamed of was sort of like a drug you could give to someone, get them to commit all sorts of unspeakable acts, and they wake up the next day and they don't remember what they've done.
They were looking into brainwashing. They were looking into mind control. They were looking into how they could create what they called Manchurian candidates. They were trying to figure out if they could get people to go out and do things that they would ordinarily not do, like assassinations.
The case of MKUltra has to be one of the craziest cases of blowback in CIA history. Because here they took this drug, LSD, and thought that they were going to be able to use it to control people's minds. And the unbelievable irony is that LSD is a drug that does exactly the opposite. It frees your mind and causes people to question authority.
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
The CIA's attempt to control people turned out to be just the opposite. It created the counterculture, as we know it, of the 60s. It was the CIA that introduced LSD to the United States.
So not only was the goal of this program brainwashing, but also reprogramming to get the victim to do anything the CIA wanted, even assassinations, and without the victim having the slightest memory of what he had done. The United States was concerned during the Korean War, where many American prisoners of war were confessing to the Koreans that they had actually used germ warfare on their country and were apologetic. Over 7,000 POWs petitioned the U.S. to end the war, and 21 of the soldiers even refused to return to the United States after the war. Well, Washington thought all of this was because of brainwashing techniques, which they thought had been used on the soldiers, but that was not the case. However, it did not prevent the U.S. from starting this aggressive and inhumane program to learn how to control humans by brainwashing them. Officially, the MKUltra program ended when information started seeping out after Olson's case was finally looked into. You know, he was the guy I introduced to you at the beginning of the program, the scientist who was set up to look like he committed suicide, but was most likely killed by the same CIA that he had worked for. It seemed that after he was given an LSD dosage, that he had a bit of a conscience and couldn't take the torture to others any longer. And Gottlieb and others, even higher up, knew that he needed to be silenced before he exposed what they were doing. Much about this program came to light 20 years after Olson's death, and because of the public exposure, the program was officially ended. However, there are those who say it never really ended, but just took on other forms. Let's get my guests involved in this discussion.
James Martinez is a media ecologist, radio talk show host, and pioneer in radio broadcasting and behavior modification. Born in San Diego, California, he's an accredited member of the Press for American Media Distribution. Martinez has been a consultant for True TV's Conspiracy Theory and has consulted for Emmy Award-winning actor Ian Bailey for a show entitled Imagine This.
Well, thank you so much, James, for being with us. I'd like to start off with this. How would you describe MKUltra to our audience?
MKUltra was brought over from Europe during World War II, where they were perfecting behavior modification using child abuse and satanic cult ritual. Those were the melting pots for what was to be used. Originally, most people think MKUltra had to do with being able to utilize behavioral software to override the conscious mind of an individual that was pre-programmed for instance, assassination. But it wasn't only for assassination. It was used for political purposes as well. And it was done through ritualistic abuse originally. That's how it started. These ritual abusive techniques were used to create deep-seated trauma within the psyche, and then around the trauma, build and program personalities for certain functions to be used. MKUltra, originally, what people know it from is being able to take the free will of an individual, any individual, and get them to commit murder without them knowing it or even remembering it, and carrying it out skillfully and discreetly so that it could be utilized for political purposes, for altering the chessboard pieces on the grand chessboard, so to speak. That's what it was for originally, but it has far more profound effects today.
I mean, that's really mind-boggling what you said. How successful would you say that program was?
Very successful, very successful. In 1990, when I was working with Walter Boert, we had and interviewed hundreds of people that survived ritualistic satanic abuse. Some were in the private sector, some were in the military, and some were utilized in Vietnam for assassination. And Walter Boert originally, what inspired him to write the book was discovery of deep-seated amnesia with a lot of the soldiers that came back from Vietnam. And he was always very sensitive to the whole idea of warfare as a whole. But what he really, really was concerned about was the battle over the mind. And we knew in 1990 that that's where the high ground was. And the end of the road, and We've reached that now. We knew in 1990 that free will, freedom of speech, and cognitive liberty would be the biggest issues on the planet. And this today is where we're at, because we are now in the process of merging our central nervous system to